This is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS. Original Forces programs. Spitfire 80. How she won the war.
Children eat ice cream and play together, supervised by an adult worrying about them going too near to the edge. To my right, a couple in their 60s take pictures with an expensive camera and marvel at the weather, the great visibility, claiming they can make out Calais. For thousands of years, people have sought to conquer Britain right here. From Gallic wars with Julius Caesar in 55 BC, through to bombs dropping from the heavens in the 40s. Right here. Like a target painted on the land itself. These cliffs are ancient and silent spectators. It's hard to imagine this peaceful outlook, now favoured by tourists, was once the watching platform from a threat seeking to change the world. The wounds and mental fear of the Zeppelin raids were still fresh, but if the rumours coming out of mainland Europe were to be believed, fear would soon make way to terror. A new and all-powerful German air threat was coming. Whispers since 1920 of the Germans' steady expansion of paramilitary actions, secret production facilities, flying training centres and confirmed sightings of high-speed mail planes and sporting single-seaters were rife. And they were accurate. These machines would become bombers, fighters, Hitler's army in the sky, and the Third Reich's plan of an eternal and indestructible pillar for the German state. After two decades of growing fear, in 1939 the Luftwaffe went into World War II, having a frontline flying strength of nearly 4,200 planes, in comparison to the Royal Air Force, who had a fleet of just 640 fighters. Hurricanes and the Spitfire. It was that short-ranged, high-performance interceptor aircraft that would defend our skies and soar forever into the hearts of the people of Britain. The Spitfire is the most famous plane of World War II. Its revolutionary design and superior specifications gave the British a clear advantage fighting the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. Commonly referred to in feminine form, she is still an iconic figure 80 years later. But what is her story? How did she become the symbol of victory?
We've all grown up with the notion that one man, Reginald J. Mitchell, designed the Spitfire. Well, it's patently obvious that one man can't design and do everything. Engine, hydraulics, wing shape, structure, the maths involved. There aren't enough hours in the day. So, like all these things in the 1930s, it was always the boss who got the credit.
Author and historian Paul Beaver.
We tend to think of Spitfires as being a male environment. This is about the Battle of Britain fighter pilot, the silk scarf flying, you know, the devil-may-care attitude. Actually, let's take another look at this and say, without women, there wouldn't have been a Spitfire.
The sustained aerial attacks of World War II ensured the statistics were horrendous. The Luftwaffe bombed indiscriminately. Military or civilian, night, even day. Generations of families wiped out in the blink of an eye. Women were called to the factories, called to support the war effort. And for the first time, British women took on a variety of new jobs, traditionally unsuitable because they were either dirty or difficult. Shock and sadness soon made way to defiance, spirit, and opportunity. A new wave of inspired women stepped forth, seizing the opportunity, seduced by the thrill of mechanics, engineering, mathematics, and technology. Their contribution was vital to the war effort and to the creation of Spitfire. Her story is just as charming and spirited as the women who built her, perfected her, and flew her.
The role of women in the story of the Spitfire is epic. It's the role that they played in its life story. They funded it, they maintained it, they developed it, they flew it, they delivered it, they modified it. Even the name is directly attributable to a woman. And it's an unknown story. We've got to capture that story before it's too late. Trying to research the origins of the Spitfire from the, if you like, the aeronautical perspective, we need to go back to 1929 and Britain winning the Schneider Trophy. This is where the first woman gets involved. The Schneider Trophy was the speed competition of the day. It was as important as a European Cup final, as the Rugby World Cup, as a test match, if not more so. When the Schneider Trophy race at Leon Solent down in Hampshire took place, 2 million people took the day off work to come and watch. 2 million people came to watch aeroplanes flying at speeds that were unimaginable.
Waghorn is going well. He has already lapped the Italian Molin in the first lap. Actually, has just completed a lap at about 324 miles per hour.
The Schneider Trophy was won by Great Britain for the fourth time by Flying Officer H.R.D. Waghorn.
Britain was in a really bad situation at the end of the 20s, early 30s. We'd had the Wall Street crash, we'd had the financial crisis that was going on in the United States. Europe was in trouble. And the national government of Ramsay MacDonald said, there's no money to do this. This is just a bunch of young airmen are having fun. This is where Lucy, Lady Houston, gets involved. She was so appalled by the fact that the government wouldn't spend, in her view, a measly £100,000. She almost embarrassed the government into supporting it. She just wrote a cheque for £100,000. And she said, if we win, we keep the trophy. That's really good for Britain. It's what we need. It's a boost for Britain. It meant that Supermarine, who were the seaplane builders, the speed experts, could actually work on a new aircraft. It meant that Rolls-Royce could put some of their best engineers onto making an engine that could cope with the speeds and the stresses of high-speed flight. We won the Schneider Trophy thanks to a woman. We owe a lot to Lady Houston, and I don't think we really know her.
A philanthropist, political activist, and suffragette, Lady Lucy Houston was a fierce supporter of the nation's security and technological advancement. Once famously quoted as saying, "Every true Briton would rather sell his last shirt than admit that England cannot afford to defend herself."
England cannot afford to defend herself.
She lived an active but turbulent life up until the age of 79 when she died of a heart attack in 1936. Just 3 years from when her valuable contribution to World War II would be realised.
Lady Houston's funding gave the Spitfire a heartbeat. She wanted to see us succeed as a nation in terms of new technologies, and aerospace and aeronautics at the time was the IT of the day. It's what everyone wanted to be in.
Lady Houston's financial contribution gave Supermarine the opportunity to put together a team. This group would work with the modern-day technologies of hydraulics, structures, wing shape and form, and of course, production lines. The incredible lineup, not replicated anywhere else in the world, included Elf Faddy, Alan Clifton, Joe Smith, Beverly Shenstone, and Ernie Mansbridge.
The first thing that happened was that the Air Ministry, which was then the parent body for the Royal Air Force and all aeronautics, put together a specification for a new fighter. The RAF really wasn't very keen on this idea of a monoplane fighter. And the aircraft which won the competition was a biplane, but with a closed cockpit, called the Gladiator. Lovely aeroplane, two machine guns. Wasn't really going to do any damage, just slightly slower than a German bomber. Not really an act of war. Mitchell's design, which was really a hodgepodge. The engine wasn't really very good. It was a cranked wing, fixed undercarriage. It had the cooling system on the undercarriage legs. It was just a Meccano of an aeroplane. It was thrown out, and the report that came from the Air Ministry was damning about it, really put Mitchell off. So he gave the next specification which came along for a fighter aircraft with machine guns, monoplane, faster than 300 miles an hour, high rate of climb. He gave that to Al-Fadi and the team to be the design lead on. He then went away and started working on a high-speed amphibian, which he really liked seaplanes, and on a bomber. Now, his bomber design would have been faster, gone higher, carried more bombs than the Lancaster, and it was 5-6 years ahead of it. Really, really interesting. There was no doubt that Mitchell was a genius, but it was a team that developed the Spitfire, and that team came together as a result of technology, as a result of the threat, and the result of far-sightedness in the Air Ministry in saying, we need to go to the next generation now. Next year will be too late. You must look at Mitchell, if you like, as the conductor of a great orchestra. He knew how to pick people. He picked Al-Fadi from a small aeroplane company in Bristol and said to him, I want you to be the design team leader of this. Put your team together. I know you're not very good at maths, so you better get a mathematician. You need to sort out some wing design. And Fadi said, look, there's this guy, Beverly Shanston. I know you don't like graduates, RJ, but he's a graduate. He's got a master's degree from the University of Toronto. He's got a PhD from the University of Heidelberg. He's a glider pilot. He understands wings. Look at this design he's done. The elliptical wing, which gives you everything you want, maneuverability and speed. It was Fadi who brought this together, convinced Mitchell about it. There's a great story that the Fadi family tell of RJ and Elf sitting down in their living room, their drawing room, and actually doing aircraft designs on the wallpaper. And Mrs. Fadi, not very impressed, I would imagine.
Al-Fadi was an apprentice at Parsons, the greatest steam boiler makers in the world. Unusually for an apprentice, he didn't leave when finished. He was kept on because of his skill. He saw active service in World War I when he joined the Royal Navy Air Service. And like many of the Spitfire team, he had seen war.
They knew that there was an imperative that they had to do. Off they went. They were busy drawing and sketching. But that only takes you so far. If you're going to then convert that to something you can build from, you need to have the tracings and the blueprints done. This is where the aeronautical industry was ahead of the game, because it had recognised the talents of women. That women have a greater attention span, a greater eye for detail than men. So when you came and started drawing the aircraft and making the blueprints, you needed a team of girls, effectively. They were nearly all young, good eyesight, great hand. You've got this great team of engineering brains, but behind them and keeping them going are the ladies of the drawing office who were able to put all of this together and create the amazing blueprints. If you go to the Solent Sky Museum down in Southampton, you'll see the blueprints for the Spitfire. Just amazing pieces of artwork, but engineering art. This is all down to women.
Eileen Gray was one of the first women to join Supermarine.
I was quite a young person then, about 17 and a half years of age. I well remember the day I went for interview. For a minute, I stood paralysed, wondering what on earth I'd let myself in for. I didn't know at the time, but there was an engine run and a compass swing in action, actually in the shed. There was a Southampton on her cradle, and the terrific noise, obviously. The whole shed was vibrating under my feet, and for a young person of about 17 and a half, I wondered what on earth I had come to. He said, I'll take a chance with you, start on Monday, which I did. And I must admit, it was the commencement, to me, of a very interesting period with the whole of Supermarine Aviation Works.
Whilst employed as a clerk, Mrs. Gray also dealt with communications daily to several RAF bases. She left Supermarine and was married before the start of World War II.
The whole timeline of the Spitfire crashes together between 1938 and 1940.
Production lines began and workers were needed.
Until the Second World War, there were very few women on the shop floor. By 1940, that had completely changed.
Mr. Cunnings was a fitter at Supermarine working on Spitfire. He talks about the introduction of women during the war.
They said, you've got to have her with you. I said, no way. There's no way I'm going to have a girl or a woman working with me. I mean, you've got to have her. insist on it. I said, well, if she comes, I'm not going to show her anything. I was very definite about it. I was working on a pneumatic system, which is a series of airline pipes and that, copper pipes, and it's quite complicated. In the bottom of the copper of the aircraft, it fed the guns, it fed the flaps with air, and it was quite a business. So we fit all these in about 20 or 30 pipes, and unions and connections, the air bottles and everything. And she came with me, and she stood by the cockpit door while I put all these pipes in. Got right to the last part where we had to test the airlines and get it ready for inspection. So she watched me on that. And okay, we got that aircraft cleared, no leaks. And went on to the next aircraft, and to my surprise, she said, "Oh, she said, do you mind if I try it?" I said, "You think you can do it?" She said, "Oh, yes. So I've been watching you." So I said, "Give her a free hand." So I stood by and watched her. And give her due respect, she got every pipe in position, she got everything inked as it should be, fairies and all that sort of thing. And in the end, she said, "Well," she says, "the testing," she said, "would you carry the testing for leaks?" She said, "I didn't quite follow that." Mm-hmm. And after that, we got on marvellous together.
The one thing that they hadn't done was actually look at the engine. They suddenly realised that the German fighter, the Bf 109, could actually dive away from a contact, and if the Spitfire tried to follow, the problem was that it got a small airlock in the carburetor, which feeds fuel into the engine, and it went stut. It slowed down. It lost energy. The fix is so incredibly British. It's quite remarkable. The Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough, they had a wonderful boffin there called Tilly Schilling. And Miss Schilling was the first woman to go faster than 100 miles an hour. She designed her own motorbike to go around Brooklands. So she's already a bit of a heroine, should be in the record books. And she looked at the problem and said, "Oh, the carburetor floats the problem. In the pulling away, the bunting manoeuvre, as pilots would call it, it gets trapped. Oh, it's very simple. We'll just drill a hole in it." Oh, what a simple fix that was. So she and her team in 1940 were going around to all the fighter squadrons, presumably with a hand drill or with new floats, and putting them into all the aircraft. So suddenly we had a fix. Now, pilots being pilots, you have to have a nickname for it. So I'm afraid it became Miss Schilling's orifice, but that's part of aeronautical history. What a great lady, and what a great inspiration for female engineers. We ought to make more of her.
Beatrice Tilly Schilling, an aeronautical engineer and motor racer. In the 30s, she raced motorcycles, and after the war, she raced automobiles. Tilly's device, invented in 1941, the RAE Restrictor, was used all the way through till 1943, when the introduction of the pressure carburetor made it redundant. Tilly also worked on a variety of projects, including the Blue Streak missile and the effects of a wet runway upon braking. Often described by fellow scientists as a flaming pathfinder of women's lib, she fiercely rejected any suggestion that as a woman she might be inferior to a man in technical and scientific fields.
It's all very well to build large numbers of fighter aircraft, large numbers of Spitfires, but you've got to move them from the factories. First of all, you've got to move them to the maintenance units, because you need what's called government-furnished equipment, radios, guns. When the aircraft are damaged or need servicing, you need to move them back from the fighter squadrons, from the front line, back to the maintenance units. So there's a lot of ferry flying, as it's called, non-operational flying, to be done. There just weren't enough men to do that in the Royal Air Force or the Fleet Air Arm. We had a pool of pilots in the country. There were men and women, civilian pilots with the Royal Aero Club certificate, many of them instructors. So the first idea was, well, 1938, Munich crisis time, and Hitler was on the rampage. Let's get some men in to do that. They may have learned to fly in the First World War, too old to go into the services now. And this is fine, a lot of publicity about this. But one female pilot, one extraordinary female pilot, Pauline Gower, said, well, why not women? Women have got the same qualifications, many of them greater qualifications in terms of instruction. And it took a bit of lobbying. She was in the right place. She had family connections. She could go straight to the Secretary of State for Air. We suddenly found ourselves with female, highly qualified pilots. And we remember these as the Spitfire Girls.
the Air Transport Auxiliary recruited pilots who were considered to be unsuitable for either the Royal Air Force or the Fleet Army. Age, country of origin, and physical handicaps were ignored if the pilot could do the job. In 1939, Trailblazer Pauline Gower was granted permission and tasked with setting up the women's section of the ATA. The first eight women pilots were accepted into service in 1940. During the course of World War II, 166 female pilots flew for the ATA. Not only did Pauline Gower open the door on equality in aviation, she also ensured that females received the same pay as men of equal rank. This was the first time that the British government gave its blessing to equal pay for equal work.
The early ATA had probably two, almost call them classes, a public school head girl type personified by Pauline Gower, who was the commandant, the driving force. You then have on the other side the celebrities of the time, the It Girls, and perhaps personified by Diana Bonato Walker. Here is a celebrity, independently wealthy. She's a person who's used to drinking champagne on a nightly basis. So to her, perfectly normal to land on, grab the train, go up to Chelsea, drink some champagne, dance, come back, grab a few hours sleep, and get flying again. And able to do this for 2 years. Many of them had 1,000 hours of flying experience by the time the war came about. Several of them from the aristocracy. They were the odd honourable, the odd lady. When they came to the ATA, they were just the rank they were given. They were our second officers or first officers. As the war progresses, the people who were already pilots in the 1930s had all been used up, if you like, and all were there. They needed more. And so you then get the advertising in things like the aeroplane magazines.
I used to read the aeroplane magazine. I saw a news item that said ATA had run out of qualified pilots and were training ab initio, meaning from scratch. And I thought it felt better than working in a bank, so I applied.
Now 93 years old, Joy Lofthouse joined the ATA in December of 1943, where she began her initial 6 weeks training on her path to becoming a Spitfire girl.
When you'd done your 6 weeks, you went back to TAME and you converted on the Harvard, which was the first aircraft we'd had with retractable undercarriage, which was another button to remember, you know. And you did almost the same in miniature that you'd done on the Master, allocated instructor, a bit of dual, solo, few cross countries, not as many. And when they felt you were capable of coping with that, there in the corner of the field was this school Spitfire. A single-seater in those days, of course. And twins are an invention since the war. And you got in it and you did a couple of circuits in the Spitfire. And then you were supposedly fully qualified to fly Class 1 and Class 2. And you were posted to start earning your living for once, you know, to be a ferry pilot. A lot of our work, because I was only qualified for trainers and single-seaters, were Spitfires. I did fly a lot of Spitfires. But anything that came on the books within your category, you could fly.
Did you actually have your driving licence?
No, I didn't. I was only 17 when war was declared. And anyway, not many people in those days had cars. It was all bicycle or public transport. Although my father did have a car, but I think the driving age then was 18. But if you hadn't learned to drive before, of course, there was no petrol to teach young girls to drive. Every gallon of petrol came across the Atlantic in the convoys. No North Sea gas or anything. And what little petrol there was went to farmers and the forces and people who had to get to work, of course, compulsory work. Thank goodness they didn't ask me at my interview, but I'm not sure whether... Well, I suppose it might have helped, because I don't think I realised then, but I do realise now that I found far more difficult taxiing than I did flying. Because when the ground engineer would beckon you to where he wanted it parked, he would say, just park it just there, ma'am. And you weren't quite sure how much throttle to give it to get exactly there, which I think was lack of sort of spatial awareness that I would have got from having driven a car. But as I make people laugh saying, I never knocked him down, so I suppose it wasn't too bad.
You had some interesting ways of navigating from my research, from your cigarette packets through to maps. There was no radio communications within the planes.
Well, because we didn't know anything else. I don't know, maybe the pre-war people who'd flown had radio. I don't know. I'd never even asked them. But we weren't used to it. In fact, I was very pleased. It was lovely. You felt free as a bird. You went up there. Nobody could tell you were going the wrong way or you shouldn't be going doing this, you know. In fact, this was right when I've flown twice in the Spitfire within the last 2 or 3 years. And this was the big difference I noted. The very time I would have liked to have talked, taking off and landing, I couldn't because the pilot was talking to control and I couldn't talk over him. I thought, this is so noisy. It wasn't like this during the war. You got in the aeroplane, shut the hood, and it was dead silent, apart from the engine noise. I suppose had we had a radio and then had it taken away, lost it or something, it would have been worse. But all we knew was navigation, you know. You relied a lot on checkpoints. One of our little handling notes says, if you're looking for a strange airfield to which you've never been before, don't bother. The Royal Air Force have camouflaged it so you can't find it. So instead, we looked for checkpoints. Because we went into a lot of MUs and a lot of stations the same, you got to know where the village was in a correspondence to the airfield, or a manor house, or a certain area of woodland, you know. You were very excited, of course. This was the culmination of everything you'd hoped to be doing when you joined. Very fast, of course. But all I remember that when you opened the throttle, it was a vast surge, of course, and you look at your instruments, you throttle back to cruising speed, you shut the hood, and you think, heaven, will I ever find the airfield again? You've gone so far away in this fast aircraft. You're never too sure if you're going to find where you've left before. But you do, of course, you do. Afterwards, of course, well, one doesn't get blasé about it, but it was always exciting flying Spitfires, although I flew over 50, I think. I once saw a programme about R.J. Mitchell's life. And do you know, originally he intended to call it The Shrew?
Yes, I've
heard. He'd heard that, had you? And some senior Air Force man talked him out of it, said, no, call it after my daughter. She's a little Spitfire, you know. So I'm glad it was called that. The Shrew doesn't sound anything like good, does it?
Although never exposed to enemy aircraft, Joy recalls the events on the day of June the 5th, 1944. One day before D-Day.
They tried to keep as quiet as possible, though I'm sure the Germans could see it from the high altitude. We were clever until the last minute. They still thought we'd go across the Pas-de-Calais, not to Normandy. Months before D-Day, no one was allowed to travel to the south coast unless you lived there. Because from the air, of course, we could see what they wanted to stop people seeing. Was all the mechanised vehicles parked up the lanes all through the New Forest, and you could have walked across to the Isle of Wight on the barges. There were so many of them. When you flew again on June the 6th, it was all gone. And we knew what had happened. Of course, I didn't have a brother, but some of the girls had brothers, and even a husband, one or two had husbands that they knew were there. We couldn't see Normandy from where we were. We knew, you know, what a dreadful day it would be, and yet we knew in our hearts that it had to be.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces. The German war is therefore at an end.
With approximately 1 million aircraft written off and Bomber Command losing 42% of its aircrew, some of the highest death rates ever recorded, the cost of World War II was epic.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
the war-weary British started to rejoice.
We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
Spitfire remained in RAF frontline service until 1954. Eighty years on from her creation, there are approximately 55 Spitfires airworthy. The oldest surviving Spitfire is housed at the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, RAF Coningsby.
She is gorgeous to look at, gorgeous to fly, and like a femme fatale, she is completely and utterly irresistible. And when you walk out to one, the hairs on the back of your neck go up. And when you get into one, and certainly P7, which is our Spitfire, probably the most precious flying machine on the planet because it flew in the Battle of Britain. When you have the honour of being in that aeroplane, flying that aeroplane, the thrill never ever goes. It is the ultimate privilege.
Squadron leader Andy Millie Milliken, officer commanding of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight.
Spitfire is, as far as I'm concerned, the most beautiful, elegant flying machine that's ever been built, and it will not be surpassed. The lines of the aeroplane, the elliptical wing, the noise, the handling, there is no finer flying machine, I think, in the world. I've been very fortunate to fly jets. I've flown the Typhoon, and there is no comparison between the Spitfire and the Typhoon. It symbolises a kind of halcyon Britain. We all look back to the Battle of Britain, the country drew together, and all of the myth around the fighter itself and the pilots who flew it. It just rouses the spirit and it makes you proud to be British. Most British people, when they think about the Battle of Britain, it is still our finest hour. So seeing a Spitfire just has a kind of, it's like a national collective memory about how wonderful this country was and indeed still is.
The next time she flies overhead, the next time she captures the imagination of a whole new generation, remember her story. Remember how she secured the skies and gave us freedom.